This podcast is brought to you by Lanco Group, your business partner for engineering solutions. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
We are now joined in the studio by football historian Ian Syson. Ian, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Not a problem. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you in the studio with us because we have a lot of important things to discuss. And you can see over here to our left, we actually have one of the posters up about the football ashes.
Yeah, well, the soccer, I call it the soccer ashes because that's what it was always called, when it was known about. And it's a really important trophy that seems to have gone missing a long time ago. And there seems to be, all of a sudden, in the mid-50s, a lack of interest in this trophy, which was a very important trophy because it's an artefact that part of the artefact actually was at Gallipoli. On the person of one of the soccer players who joined the Australian Armed Forces, and so it's kind of curious that it would just disappear from consciousness, and it's really interesting to speculate on why people would lose interest on such an ornate and quite beautiful object in the mid 1950s. And I've got my own ideas, but they're kind of theories and hypotheses at the moment.
Yeah, well, tell us, for those that don't know, obviously, tell us a little bit about, obviously, what they were playing for. So it was, I believe, Australia versus New Zealand. They were playing in a tournament every year or every
It wasn't so much every year. In 1922, the first time, we played for the first time, and then against New Zealand. And then the year later, we went again, and somebody came up with the idea of a perpetual trophy for the winner of the series. And there was a razor case inside this cask that was on the person of Bill Fisher, who was at that time the secretary of the Queensland Football Association. And he donated it, and they put in the ashes of some cigars that the captains had smoked at the celebratory event after New Zealand had won the series. Okay. Now, that sounds like kind of daggy today, doesn't it? Like, you know, putting cigar ash in a... But we have to realise that in the 20s, cigar or smoke nights were really important moments of celebration, and so they were kind of culturally significant. And if you look at the history of any sport in Melbourne, for example, they talk in their history about smoke nights, which were, you know, it's like, you know, you wouldn't do it today, but it certainly was important then. So these ashes made their way into this razor case, which was then sealed up and bolted to the bottom of the casket, which was made of wood from both New Zealand and Australia, and quite a beautiful ornate object. So, it's a real trophy. It's actually got cultural and military significance as well.
And so how is the journey going to finding the ashes? Do we have any idea as to where we think they might be?
Well, they were last seen in Sydney in 1954, when they were the final time they were given to either team. Now, I've spoken to Bill Henderson, who was the keeper in that game. He's 89 and bright as a button, unbelievable. And he actually doesn't know much about the Ashes. And that's what's really interesting, that some of the players, I spoke to Ted Smith, who played for Australia in 56, he'd never heard of the Ashes. But he quickly, you know, educated himself about it, and so I've got players like Bill, you know, on the lookout. They're trying to trace what they can. But as you'd imagine, there aren't too many surviving players from that team. You know, Bill's 89, and so there are other leads that I'm following. I'm going to go to Sydney to talk with Bill and other people. But there's a journalist that who's given me some information about possible leads, but can't remember the name of the person and the information. So it's going to be a long, slow slog. But, I mean, I'm happy about doing this because even if we don't find the ashes, we'll tell a great story.
Oh, for sure.
And that's what's important to me. But if we find the ashes, then all well and good. I mean, what do we do with it when we find them?
Yeah.
Is another question. Where do we put them? Where do we store them? Do we start up a new series with New Zealand, maybe at an under-23 game, or you know, I don't know. What do we do? But, you know, let's hope we have that problem.
What would you like to see happen? Because that would be amazing to restart a tournament where our either men's or women's and women's national teams both play New Zealand's respective men's and women's national teams and compete for the Ashes.
Yeah. I mean, in the modern world, it's very hard for professional players to play to focus too much on national teams. It's we know there's always a struggle between club and country, and so it's going to be a bit hard to ask for a series to be played, but maybe a one-off game once a year. I mean, why not an Anzac Day game? You know, when the A-League's finished, maybe it could be domestic players could be selected, so domestic Australian players rather than players in Europe, because, you know, this time of year, Anzac Day is not going to be a time when clubs are going to want to let their players go. So just domestic players if the A-League season's finished. That might work really quite well.
And how significant do you think in its entirety would it be? You speak about the story of it. Do you think that just in terms of actually having it, how significant will it be just to the history of football here in Australia?
Well, it's only one lost trophy. I mean, we have dozens, scores of lost trophies. We as a code, as a game, we are hopeless at remembering where we put things. Okay, but I'm not sure that's just absent-mindedness or amnesia. I think sometimes it's quite deliberate. And there's an extent to which wave after wave after wave of management, administration in this game ignore what's gone before. We saw that, I think, with the Lowy Revolution. We saw that clear rejection of history and desire, you know, with the new football story. But he's not alone, or that revolution was not alone. The waves before that were responsible for forgetting what came before. And it's a really interesting mechanism in Australian in soccer, and I can't quite understand it. We're ashamed of our past, and I think that goes back a very long way.
You're listening to Evenings on FNR with Louise Taffer and Nick Dubino, and we have our special guest and football historian Ian Syson joining us in the studio. But joining us on the line now is the Chief Executive of Football Federation Australia, David Gallop. David, thank you so much for coming on Evenings on FNR.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
It's our pleasure. We're just discussing the football Ashes, or the soccer Ashes, as Ian is calling them. David, how committed are Football Federation Australia to Australia's football history?
Yeah, I caught the end of what Ian said, and I've got to say I agree that the game does a poor job of celebrating its history. It's something that I've said a number of times, and something that we would love to see improved. I think there have been some improvements, but the fact that the game's history, much of it is in a storage unit in Botany, in Sydney, is a poor thing for the sport.
The Ashes aren't so in that box, are they, David?
No, we haven't looked for them, Ian. But, yeah, in terms of this specific issue, we are fascinated by it. I certainly didn't know about the so-called football Ashes. I mean, missing now since the 1950s, and we sort of join Ian and others in making a call out to, I guess, firstly the football family, but then beyond that, to see if we can find this trophy.
David, it's Nick here, and can you tell us a little bit about what the FFA are doing in particular to help find these Ashes?
I think we can start with a broad appeal to the football family, maybe through our digital channels, and see whether that sheds any light on maybe the last time somebody saw the Ashes, or maybe even to the extent that the people that were involved at the time can recall what might have happened. That would be a good start, I think, but open to ideas, and I'm sure Ian's got a few.
Yeah, well, I've been talking, David, with a few of the players, and they are a little bit vague, but they are pointing me in interesting directions, and so I'm pretty sure that a trip to Sydney and maybe elsewhere might well be quite rewarding for me. And if I can use my detective skills that I've developed over the years as a researcher and apply to this task, I may well be able to find them if they still exist.
And to the extent that you need some, assistance getting to Sydney, and once you're here, Ian, we'd be happy to help.
That's terrific to hear. Thanks, David.
Yeah, that is very terrific to hear, David, and I'm sure that Ian really appreciates your support. You touched on the fact that we aren't doing a very good job at keeping track of our history. How far off do you think we are to creating our own football museum?
I think it's a great aspiration. I think you've got to be careful when these things are established to expect that they'll easily pay for themselves. I think there's experience not only overseas but even in Australian sport where you need to be careful when trying to establish these kind of things that you don't set unrealistic targets around visitation, etc. If you do it in the right place, particularly I think somewhere where there's always football traffic, if you like, if you can do it somewhere where football people are often coming, then of course people will visit it a first time, but it's really to make it a viable commercial venture, you need to be looking at somewhere where people will make repeat visits. And of course a really good place to do this kind of thing is in a headquarters for the game, so a home of football. We've seen that obviously in other sports and in football globally as well.
I've been speaking with colleagues about this idea, and I think we're coming to the conclusion that what we need is a digital museum, and what we need is to trace and track all of the important trophies, records, and so forth, and maybe leave them where they are, but actually cover them digitally. So like if we can find out where every NSL trophy is, for example, then rather than collect them in a museum, collect them on a website and say, and point people who go to the website at the various trophies. And I think that's going to be much more successful than trying to gather material in one location, which would be really hard to access for lots of people as well. The thing is about soccer is that we have so many trophies. We have so many stories. We have so many people, so many archives. It's going to be so difficult. We're a much bigger game. We're a much more geographically spread game than all of the other football codes, and that's something that's going to make it really hard to have it one centralised, unified museum.
Yeah, another idea is you can establish these sorts of things in a mobile sense.
Yep.
So do a tour of some of the key memorabilia, key trophies, etc., and then look to house them somewhere like that. I've seen that work, obviously, in rugby league when I was involved in that sport. We had a touring semi-trailer effectively taking things around during the centenary of the game.
And Ian, just before we let David go, you touched on the fact that Anzac Day is fast approaching. Can you remind us of the link of the Football Ashes with Gallipoli?
Well, the Football Ashes, part of the trophy was actually at Gallipoli on the person of Bill Fisher, who was a player and who was wounded and sent back to discharged back to Australia. He was so badly wounded he had typhoid, and but he got involved in the Return Services Sports League, and he joined the Return Services soccer team, and he became the secretary of the Queensland Football Association in 1923. So he'd fought and was wounded. He was actually wounded early in May, like the 2nd of May. So you can see that's not very long after he landed. He was at the landing and on the 25th, and he was injured a week later. So there's a direct connection between the trophy and Anzac.
And it is so important to remember that we need to try and keep hold of mm-hmm. this history.
Yeah.
And as you touch on, I don't think many people actually realise how many trophies we do have.
Yeah. Well, look, I one thing that I really want to emphasise is that we are the most popular game in Australia, the most populous game in Australia, and it stories and facts about our game remain hidden. And I put a few examples before, like, were we playing soccer in Lismore in 1927? And if we were, who won? And how do we find out? Now, just as a little experiment, I typed into Google just before I came on air, who won the 1936 Melbourne Soccer Championship? And the answer was, the first thing on Google was a Wikipedia page which gave us the VFL Grand Final. Okay? So, and you had to go all the way down the page before you could find anything about soccer. And it was nothing to do with the question that I'd asked, where do we find this information? Mark Borich is a fantastic local historian. He believes that what we should do is have all of the yearbooks online, and he believes the FFA should mandate that for all the federations to get the yearbooks information online as PDFs or as digital information if possible.
And David, while you're still on the line, do you think that if we don't find the football ashes, we could possibly recreate it?
Yeah, I guess a replica is not a bad plan B, but it would be wonderful to find the real thing. So I don't think we should necessarily give up on that task. Obviously a replica is one answer if we end up not finding the real trophy.
And how important is it to keep the tradition alive between, you know, our Australian national teams playing against our very close friends across the ditch?
Yeah, it's an important rivalry in Australian sport. I guess in some respects, when we play, we have this unique opportunity to play all over the world, both for the Socceroos and the Matildas and our junior national teams. And it's a challenge for us to meet our obligations in terms of Asian football, but also, of course, big European countries, big South American countries. People love seeing Australian football against those nations as well. So something like the Ashes adds a little spice to an Australia-New Zealand game that other rivalries don't have. Of course, we've played England a number of times. The Socceroos have played England in England, but it would also be wonderful to think that one day Australia could play England in Australia. There's lots of challenges to that, travel and costs and calendar being the main ones, but we have to remember that the great thing about our sport is that there's 211 countries that play the game, and we're really lucky to be able to be a global sport.
Well, David, we know it's a very, very busy time for yourself and your colleagues there at Football Federation Australia and the head office in Sydney, but we thank you so much for coming on Evenings on FNR and giving up so much of your time.
Hey, thanks, guys. I think it's a great issue that you've raised, and I look forward to talking to Ian more about how we can help.
Excellent.
That was the Chief Executive of Football Federation Australia joining us there, David Gallop, to get his insight on the Football Ashes and where they stand and how much they are committed to finding them.
It certainly seems that we do have a lot of support in the upper echelons of FFA, so that's really pleasing. I mean, I just hope that level of support for something that really is almost peripheral. You know, it's a great thing, and if we find it, I'll be over the moon. Mm. But I really the other issue that I raised, that issue of local records that we need to have access to as a game. We need to be reminded that we were playing the game at this town, in this place, at this stage of history. Because at the moment we have places like one example, Warwick in Queensland, which is out of about 100k out of Toowoomba, or maybe a bit closer. And I discovered that in 1912 they started playing the game there. And it was amazing. And the competition just grew like wildfire. A lot of little coal mines around, so a lot of Scottish migrants were playing for these teams. And I contacted the local people, the local soccer organisation, and I said, are you aware that the game goes back to 1912. And they said, we had no idea. We thought it started in the 50s and then fell away. And then we restarted it in the 70s. But no, the game goes all the way back to 1912. And we need a place where that information is just clear. So people playing soccer in Warwick can, you know, have a website where they can go to and say, oh, wow, we're part of this tradition that goes all the way back to 1912.
We almost need like an archive.
We do. We need an archive. And one of my great fantasies is a map. One of those maps where you roll the cursor over and you roll over a town and information comes out about that town. So I'm in my own hometown, Mount Isa. They started playing there in 1927, you know. And the game was played continuously from that point. And, you know, people there at the moment, you know, probably know very little about the history of the town, the game in the town. And that story gets told across Australia. At Mildura, the game goes back to the 1890s. You know, there's a at Foxtel are running a little doco on a Mildura team that lost 9 players in the war, in the First World War, where they're talking to the people in the Federation who know nothing about this history. And, you know, they should, and we all should. You know, respect for the past, but also that respect for the past will give us confidence as a game. We belong here. We have legitimacy. Because too often soccer people question their own legitimacy, I think.
Has there been any word as well, maybe from the New Zealand Football Federation? Have you reached out to them to see if they're interested in looking to...
Not yet, but a couple of Kiwi journalists have been following it. It was Andrew Voormans, is it?
I think it's some other, yeah.
Yeah, he said, wow, this is really interesting. But I was interviewed 5 years ago by a Kiwi journalist about this very topic, and they produced an article. And that's also a problem. You know, we can tell these stories, but if we tell the story, our job's not done because we've got to tell the story again. This is something Roy Hayes says. We've got to tell the story, then we have to tell it again, and then we have to tell it again. I mean, suppose Roy, you know, does tell stories again and again and again. He's allowed to. So it's not just a matter of just revealing it once because it will be forgotten. We've got to keep that storytelling going.
And you've written a couple of books as well.
One book, and I've got another one underway, I guess. But and I've written quite a few articles and academic pieces. But I'm certainly trying to. I've recently retired from my academic job, so now I'm going to be a full-time researcher.
Well. Yeah. It's great to hear, and we are always looking to get behind you and, you know, promote finding the soccer ashes. And if anyone has any clue as to where they are, get in touch with Ian.
Yeah, we'll get in contact with the station, and you know, the station knows how to get onto me. And, you know, with a bit of luck, we'll be getting the show back underway if you know your history, and we'll be able to talk more about it there.
We are looking forward to it, Ian. And thank you so much for joining us in the studio this evening.
Not a problem.
We're going to take a quick break, but there's plenty more still to come.